herself that she's doing the right thing, even though she's scared to death, completely out of her element, and wondering how she's ever going to summon the nerve to do what has to be done. The Brasserie, located in an Art Nouveau building off Chestnut Street, is one of the most elegant restaurants in Philadelphia. The dining room's soaring ceilings, marble floors, and arched windows bear testimony to its former life as a turn-of-the-century bank. Now, cushy banquettes fill the room, along with tables set with linen tablecloths and bone china and vases of roses. At one of them sits Bitsy Sloane. "Ah, Lucinda, there you are." Lucinda, not sweetheart or darling or honey. No, Bitsy Sloane is not one for endearments, not unless she's talking to her ridiculous squirrel-sized white dog, whose name Lucinda can't even remember, as if it even matters, because again, her mother calls the dog sweetheart and darling and honey. "Hello, mother." Lucinda plants a perfunctory kiss on her mother's powdered, papery cheek. Bitsy Sloane is tastefully, expensively clothed, bejeweled, coiffed, made up, and perfumed. Her dyed brown pageboy brushes the shoulders of her red Dior suit, which drapes from her size zero frame just as it would from a hanger. Lucinda, wearing a slightly rumpled black Prada pantsuit she took from the back of her closet, takes the seat across from her. Immediately, a handsome tuxedoed waiter with slick black hair appears. He pours coffee and fresh-squeezed orange juice and hands them menus encased in rich leather binders, their creamy stock embossed in old English typeface. Lucinda surveys the choices. Escargot. Foie gras. She closes the menu, puts it aside, and amuses herself by fantasizing about treating her mother to breakfast at the Denny's out on Industrial Highway, where she'd have to decide between the Lumberjack Slam and Moons Over My Hammy. Moons. Lucinda thinks about the Beethoven sonata that mysteriously appeared on her iPod, and about the movie that was ordered on her online account. Moonlight Sonata. Moonstruck. That DVD was no accident. When she called the online store's customer service department, they told her that the order had been placed around Valentine's Day and that a receipt had automatically been sent to her email account. She couldn't find one. Not until she checked her recently deleted email folder. She had never seen it, nor deleted it. But someone had. And from her home computer, right before she went away with Jimmy. She immediately changed the password for the online store account and changed her email address as well. "I wasn't sure you were coming." The words are spoken crisply from behind Mother's menu, jarring her. In other words, you're late. "I'm sorry, Mother. I had business to take care of." When she left her apartment, Neil, who had come right over last night with Detective Ruzhitska as soon as she'd called to tell him about the flowers, was back. Today, he'd brought the detective again, along with a security consultant. "I want to make sure you're safe here," Neil told her as the consultant went around the apartment with a clipboard, a pen, and measuring tape, shaking his head every now and then. "I am safe. No one's been here. It was a florist delivery this time, not a personal one."
"I realize that, but he's been here before. He's going to come back."
Not he might. He's going to. He. Who is he? Neil assured her he'd take the information about the flowers to the Long Beach Township Police.
"I'll handle it, Lucinda. You just go to brunch with your mother, like you were planning."
This is the last place she wants to be. But then, so is her apartment. Really, the only place she wants to be is with Randy. She called him last night to tell him what had happened.
"I'll come right out there," was his first response.
"No, please don't. It's not urgent."
Yes, it is.
Someone sent me flowers, Randy. That's not exactly an emergency.
Don't be cavalier. You and I both know you could be in danger.
Not any more than I was before. She kept her misgivings to herself. He had enough to worry about. Anyway, Neil is coming. He'll take care of things.
I know he will.
The leather binder across the white linen tablecloth lowers abruptly, jerking Lucinda back to the present. Her mother's frosted pink lips are pursed, either because she doesn't like anything on the menu, or because she didn't like Lucinda's reason for being late to brunch. Probably both. The hovering waiter is there in a flash.
Have you decided, ladies?
Mother orders a poached egg on dry wheat toast. Lucinda, not hungry, nonetheless orders crepe aux framboises with caramelized bananas and candied pecans, applewood smoked bacon, and a side of white truffle frites, and a glass of Laurent Perrier, Brut Millésime, 1997 vintage. She is rewarded with a disapproving look from her mother, and an approving one from the waiter.
We're celebrating, are we? Some champagne for you as well, madame?
Madame's lips purse harder, if that's possible.
No, thank you.
I wish you would, mother.
Why?
Are we celebrating something?
No. It would just be nice to see you loosen up for once. The waiter has discreetly vanished again.
Tell me what you've been doing lately, mother.
Because God knows I can't tell you what I've been doing. Bitsy tells her about her role in an art auction, a civic restoration project, a charity ball, about having the indoor pool resurfaced, and about trying to replace the chauffeur. Same old, same old.
Your father sends his best regards.
But not his love. How is he? Lucinda asks.
He was in the Orient last week. He's in Europe this week and into next.
No, I asked, how is he? Not where.
Bitsy Sloane blinks her crepey beige shadow-creased eyelids. Lucinda sighs inwardly.
I'd like to see him, she says, when he gets back and has some free time.
So would I.
Her mother's smile is brittle. Lucinda's BlackBerry vibrates in her bag. She waits a moment, then slips it out and checks it, holding it on her lap, out of her mother's view. It's a link to a newspaper article, sent from an address she doesn't recognize. Heart pounding, she blurts,
Mother, I need to use the ladies' room.
Bitsy Sloane starts to protest, but she's already up and striding away from the table. It smells like a funeral parlor in here. Neil reluctantly closes the door behind him, shutting out fresh air, and approaches the counter, where a woman with long, frizzy blonde hair and wire-rimmed glasses is trimming thorns from long-stemmed roses.
How can I help you?
She sets the shears aside. He pulls out his badge. Her pale-lashed eyes widen.
I need information about the person who placed an order for flowers that were delivered yesterday from your shop.
Why?
He just looks at her. She turns to a computer monitor.
Which order was it?
The flowers went to a woman named Lucinda Sloane.
He gives her address and waits while the woman presses keys and brings up the right screen.
Oh, I remember the daffodils.
You took the order?
Yes, and I remember it because it was placed weeks ago on Valentine's Day. We were doing roses, you know, and reds and pinks.
Valentine's Day stuff.
Exactly. We were just swamped in the shop that day, delivery and carry out bouquets, and in walks this guy wanting to order daffodils that wouldn't be delivered for a month. And he paid in cash, too.
What was his name?
She checks the screen.
Let's see. It was Randall Barricat.
That stops Neil in his tracks, but only for a moment.
What kind of man was he? Young, old, middle-aged? Neil asked her.
Middle-aged, I think, maybe.
You think? Maybe?
Don't lose patience, Neil.
So you're not sure?
Valentine's Day is our busiest day of the year.
Yes, and I'm sure he was counting on that.
How old would you consider middle-aged?
You know, maybe in his 40s, 50s, 60s.
That's a broad range.
She shrugs.
Randy, who is closing in on 40, doesn't look a day over 30.
Was he handsome?
Not that I remember.
As far as Neil has ever noticed, there isn't a woman alive who wouldn't consider Randy Barraquette handsome.
White, black, Asian, Hispanic.
White, definitely.
She looks pleased with her recall skills.
And, you know, he had gray hair.
Are you sure?
Positive.
Not black.
No, I told you, he was white.
I meant his hair.
It wasn't white, really, it was gray.
Patience, Neil.
Can you think of anything else to describe this guy?
Not really. I told you this place was really
busy that day. Got it. Do you remember anything else about him? Anything at all?
Nothing other than the fact that he tipped me.
He tipped you?
Yes, with a bunch of ones. Most deliveries don't pay cash, and they don't tip the person who takes the order.
That's interesting. It doesn't shed much light on who they're dealing with, but Neil would bet his life that it wasn't Randy Barraquette.
Buffalo International Airport is compact and nowhere near as busy as the Metropolitan New York City Terminal Cam just left. Without luggage, she's in the rental car about 5 minutes later, consulting the driving directions she printed from the internet the night before. According to them, it should take her all of 15 minutes to reach the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus. With the roads slick and a light snow falling, it takes 20. Cam arrives wishing it had taken an hour, at least. She doesn't feel prepared to meet Janet O'Leary. What if she isn't there? What if she is? What am I going to say to her? What if she tells me to get lost? Worst of all, what if she doesn't even remember? I should just go home. What am I doing here? Looking for answers. Answers that have been a hell of a long time coming. The multi-building complex, sleek brick and glass and steel, is still under construction, as she had known it would be. She did her homework on that, at least. But what do I do when I get to where I'm going? What do I say to her? I should just go home. But she parks the car and forces herself to push ahead through the wet, wind-driven snow. She'd recognize that she's reached the Roswell Park Cancer Institute, even without the identifying sign. Everywhere, there are patients in various stages of the disease, some being helped from their cars into wheelchairs, others painstakingly using walkers or breezing along wearing telltale turbans and wigs. The lobby is a lovely four-story atrium, complete with a granite information desk, a cappuccino bar, a pianist playing a jaunty show tune on a grand piano. If it weren't for the fact that the place is filled with obvious cancer patients, along with medical staff wearing laminated ID cards, Cam could be standing in an upscale hotel lobby. For a moment, she wishes she had done that instead, hopped a plane to some island paradise and checked into a resort where she could hide away and pretend everything is normal. Status quo. But it isn't. And she didn't. She came here looking for answers. Looking for answers where there probably are none. Looking for a killer where there probably is none. This is a mistake. She has no business disturbing layers of dust settled over the secrets of the past. Ava is long gone, like their mother. Soon Pop will be too. But Cam has a family that needs her now. She has a husband who loves her, and a new baby girl, and a daughter she almost lost. Whatever, Mom, have a safe trip. This isn't safe, and it isn't smart,
and she should leave well enough alone, get on with her life. Then, a beautifully dressed, utterly hairless woman passes Cam, catches her eye, and smiles. She wears her baldness proudly. Not, Cam realizes, having given up the battle, but having brazenly accepted it. If she can do this, Cam finds herself thinking, then Lord knows I can do anything. Jaw set, she walks toward the information desk. I'd rather be in Philadelphia. He read that someplace a long time ago. Who said it? He can't remember, but the quote has been ringing in his ears all morning as he walks the familiar streets of Society Hill beneath a dank canopy of clouds, wishing he were somewhere else. Somewhere other than Philadelphia. He spent a lot of time here, but it doesn't feel like home. Nor did the upstate New York City where he settled last June to become an upstanding citizen just long enough for the parole officers to relax a little. The Bronx neighborhood where he'd spent the first 18 years of his life might have felt like home at one time, before his father was gunned down on a sidewalk right in front of their building. He and his mother stayed there, though, afterward. They stayed until he graduated high school, and Ricky Parker across the hall was murdered in his own apartment, and the killer wasn't caught, and his mother decided the neighborhood was getting dangerous. He didn't miss the old neighborhood, nor does he miss the one that came after, in Yonkers. He can't think of anywhere that ever really has felt like home, except, perhaps, for the maximum security prison, where he was housed with over 2,000 other men, most of them fellow violent offenders, career criminals, mingling with first offenders. Like him. Ha. Oh, wait. Not the prison. The correctional facility. That was back in the dawn of state prison reform. The governor appointed special committee's decision to change the name of the dismal concrete box didn't change much of anything else. Still, you spend 3.5 decades anywhere. It's going to feel familiar. And as far as he's concerned, when something is familiar, it's home. It isn't that he wanted to stay incarcerated, or would have if he could have, or would ever want to go back. Hell no. 35 years was long enough to spend behind bars for the inadvertent, sloppy murder of the only woman who had ever thought twice about him. He lost control that night. Never again. One of the neighbors heard Mother's screams. Almost immediately, sirens wailed. How could this be happening? He wondered, as he fled into the night, panicked. He had executed so many flawless murders. He had sat back and laughed for a couple of years as the authorities hunted for the elusive night watchman. One impulsive move, and he was living his worst nightmare. They chased him down in the dark like an animal. They got him. One of the arresting officers called him a crazy son of a bitch as he slapped on the handcuffs. He's crazy, all right. Crazy like a fox. Ha. Fox. Funny. The law enforcement and judicial powers that be thought they had the upper hand. But right from the start, they were wrong. A little over a week after he killed his mother, the first Vietnam draft lottery took place for all men born between 1944 and 1950. The first number chosen was September 14th. He had been born on September 14th, 1950. When he heard the outcome of the lottery, he laughed his head off, knowing that his arrest had saved his life, knowing that the almighty draft board couldn't touch him behind those 30-foot concrete walls. Prison was bearable because he knew that one day he'd get out. With Vietnam, there would have been no such guarantee. I'm sorry about that, Mother. Bitsy Sloan looks up from her hands, clasped in her lap, almost as if she's been praying. Lucinda knows better than that. She doubts her mother prays even at St. John's Presbyterian, where she appears every Sunday morning without fail, just as generations of supposedly pious Sloanes have done before her. It's just for show, as far as Lucinda is concerned. Why would Mother believe in God when she doesn't believe in her own daughter? Bitsy nods at the seat Lucinda vacated and the untouched meal that has appeared before it. Sit down. Your food is getting cold, and so is mine. Lucinda remains standing, looking longingly at the untouched flute of golden champagne at her place setting. She could use a swig right about now, to help face what lies ahead, well beyond the inevitable confrontation with her mother. Needless to say, this is not going to go over well. I'm sorry. I have to leave. Bitsy digests this with all the enthusiasm she has for the food in front of her. Now? In the middle of brunch? It can't be helped. She hesitates, wondering whether to provide any more information than that. Are you sick, Lucinda? Would it change anything if her mother knew the truth? Yes, I'm not feeling well. Bitsy sighs heavily, too much a lady to betray her emotions any more animatedly than to say quietly, I'm disappointed. Lucinda wishes she could believe it's because her mother is concerned for her health, or because her mother was looking forward to spending some quality time with her. But it isn't about that, of course. It never has been. Lucinda has no illusions. She knows she's as much an obligation to her mother as her mother is to her. As for her father, well, Rudolph Sloane doesn't seem to feel obligated to either of them. For a moment, Lucinda really does consider telling her mother the reason she has to leave. There's been a murder, Mother. Another murder, and the killer is on the loose, and I think he's been in my apartment watching me. And if we don't catch him, I might be next. If she says all of that out loud, what difference will it make? Her mother will worry. She's cold, but she's not inhuman. Beneath the sharp edge lies some semblance of maternal caring. Her mother will also blame her for what's happened. Blame her being in the press, talking about murder. Blame her having made it her life's work to come into contact not just with victims of crime, but with the lowest life forms imaginable, the criminals themselves. Is it any wonder, her mother will ask, that you've captured the attention of a homicidal maniac? No, it's no wonder. But she's chosen to live her life on her own terms. She's chosen her path. So she owns it, all of it, even this. I wouldn't have it any other way, she realizes, and leaves her mother to nibble her cold poached egg and go home alone to a house made of cold gray stone. Chapter 14. Scrolling through the online edition of yet another newspaper, Vic hears the rumble of the mail truck down the street. With the exception of his college application era, and a couple of lean newlywed years when he and Kitty desperately needed their tax refund money, Vic never spent much time anticipating the arrival of the day's mail. Things are different now, and not just because the mail recently held his first book contract, or because he expects a check for his on-signing advance any day. The check would be nice. Further communication from the night watchman would be, well, not nice. But every day he holds his breath and waits for the mail to come, hoping for anything that might put him on the killer's trail once again. If the task force down in Quantico has made any progress, nobody's bothered to tell Vic. He wouldn't expect them to. They're on their own with this thing now, just as he's on his own. The guys from the field office have checked in now and then, and they drive by every so often, too. For all he knows, the house is under constant surveillance, which bothers Kitty. But as he told her, better to be watched by the FBI than by an unsub thirsty for the kill after 35 years of dormancy.
Welcoming the distraction of the mail truck, Vic leaves the computer and goes to the front door to meet it. He remembers, this time, to punch in the numbers on the alarm keypad, but sometimes he doesn't. Darned thing is a pain in the ass, but a necessary evil. Opening the door at last, Vic inhales the dank, cold air. Not quite as biting as it has been, though. Beyond the doorstep lies a drab backdrop of bare branches, sparse grass, and mud, but the crocus bulbs Kitty had him plant last fall are sending up tender, grassy sprouts over by the lamppost.
"Mornin', Vic," the mailman climbs out of his truck with a wave.
"Mornin', Smitty."
"Feels like spring, huh?"
"Almost." Vic accepts the bundle of mail. Quite a few white envelopes today, he notices. Some days, there are mostly catalogs and junk mail. Anxious to get inside and go through it, he bids Smitty a good day and hurriedly barricades himself into the house again. Standing in the hall, he flips through the envelopes. The third one in the stack captures his attention. It's addressed to him, a plain white typewritten label again. No return address. It was postmarked 3 days ago in Chicago. Waiting beside the secretary's desk in the first floor pastoral care office, Cam rehearses what she'll say to Janet O'Leary. One thing is certain. The woman has most likely never heard of her, or of Ava. She'll have to start there. Okay, so, "Hi, my name is Cam, and I think that when you were a little girl, you got a look at the man who killed my sister." And then Janet O'Leary, a cancer survivor herself who spends her days as a lay minister to patients here, will tell Cam to leave, and rightly so, because she has far more important things to worry about today. So does Cam. When she called Mike a few minutes ago to tell him she'd arrived, she could hear Grace wailing in the background. Her heart sank.
"What's wrong with her, Mike?"
"She's just a little cranky. She'll be fine."
Cam checks her watch. There's an afternoon flight home. If she leaves here in the next 10 minutes, she can probably get on it standby.
"Hi."
A small woman enters the office, accompanied by the secretary who went off to locate her on her patient rounds.
"You're here to see me?"
A look at her ID badge confirms that. Cam nods.
"Hi, Ms. O'Leary. My name is Cam Hastings."
She nods, wearing an expectant expression. When the secretary asked for Cam's name, she asked, "Will Janet know who you are or what this is in regard to?"
"No," Cam said simply, "but it's very important."
Now, she tells Janet,
"I know you're really busy, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I was wondering if I could ask you about something in private."
She expects Janet to ask for more information, but she nods. Then she crosses the small reception area, pokes her head into an adjoining office, looks around, and tells Cam,
"Empty. We're in luck. Sometimes it isn't. We all share this office. Come on in."
They settle themselves beside a desk covered in papers, a computer, and a telephone. Cam looks at Janet, who has a halo of soft brown hair and wide-set eyes the ice-blue shade of a winter sky. Somewhere other than here, anyway.
"I'm here because my sister died," Cam blurts,
not at all as she had rehearsed.
"Cancer."
"No."
How had she intended to phrase it?
The right words have flown out of her head, and she has to be careful here to avoid the wrong ones. She needs Janet O'Leary to listen to her, to help her, if there's any way. She may be the only one who can. Sandra Wubner's parents have both died, and she was an only child.
It happened a long time ago. She'd be in her late 50s if she were still alive. She died when she was 20, in college. They said it was a suicide."
At the last word, something flickers in Janet's blue eyes, but she says nothing.
"All these years, my father and I believed Ava, that's my sister's name, Ava Neary."
No recognition there.
"We believed she had killed herself. There were reasons to think she might have, I guess. My mother had abandoned us, just disappeared without a trace, not long before that.
I'm so sorry, Janet murmurs, touching her hand.
Cam is unnerved by her kindness, her sympathy. All those years, Cam and her father had dealt with their losses on their own. A woman like this, a woman who spends her days helping stricken people cope with emotional and spiritual pain, could have made it all so much, well, not easier, but perhaps more bearable.
Not long ago, Cam goes on, I was given some information that led me to wonder if my sister really did kill herself.
Or, Janet supplies when she can't bring herself to say it.
Or not.
Janet digests this.
You aren't saying she might still be alive?
No.
You're saying someone else might have taken her life?
Cam exhales, almost in relief, and nods. Janet O'Leary tilts her head.
Why are you here to see me, Mrs. Hastings?
Please, call me Cam. Your maiden name was Toscano, wasn't it? And you grew up on the West Side?
How did you know that?
Newspaper archives, Cam tells her. Wedding announcement, an interview you did about your work here, and, really long ago, an article about your babysitter.
Now the recognition dawns.
She hung herself, Janet, and you found her. Do you remember?
Sandy. Yes, I remember.
Janet O'Leary's lovely eyes have clouded over. And you said you saw her boyfriend with her that night.
I remember that, too.
The police investigated. Her boyfriend had an alibi.
Janet shakes her head. I know that, but I got out of bed for a drink of water, and when I looked in the living room, someone was there, talking to her. At the time, I just assumed it was her boyfriend. He'd come over sometimes.
But now you think it might have been someone else?
I guess it could have been.
How sure are you that someone was there?
At the time, I was 100% sure.
But later, well, I guess the police and my parents seemed to think I either dreamed it or imagined it, especially once her boyfriend gave them the alibi. They said I was traumatized, and it was understandable.
I guess I believed them after a while because, well, because it was less scary than thinking someone really was there.
Looking back, though, now, you think someone really could have been?
Janet nods.
Did you get a good look at him?
No, I only saw his back, and he was wearing a jacket with the hood up. It was snowing really hard that night. I remember seeing snow melting off his boots, too.
Did he or Sandy know you were there?
No, I was supposed to be asleep. I only snuck a quick peek, then I went back to bed. I still couldn't fall asleep, though, and later, when I got up again, that's when I found her.
Hanged.
Janet shudders. Yes, it was horrible.
I can just imagine.
Cam waits a moment before asking,
Do you think Sandy killed herself that night, Janet?
Rather than answer, she says, You don't, do you?
No, I don't. I think she was murdered by whoever was there, and I think he might have done the same thing to my sister.
Rounding the corner onto Lucinda's block, he's just in time to see a man exit the building. Watching with interest, he slows his pace as the man walks over to a white van parked at the curb. Seeing the sign painted on the side of the van, he breaks into a slow grin. Liberty Home Security Specialists. Obviously, Lucinda received his little gift last night and his email this morning. Feeling paranoid, is she? Then she should really enjoy the little surprise he's got in store for her next. His lips curve into a smile as he pulls it out of his pocket and looks around to see if anyone's watching. Still holding his cell phone, Randy sticks his head into the office where Dan Lambert is typing furiously at a computer.
I need to talk to you.
Lambert looks up, eyes going solemn behind his round-rimmed glasses when he sees Randy's expression.
What's up?
Someone could be in earshot. Randy closes the door. A woman was murdered last night in Chicago. It looks like whoever killed Carla could be responsible. Disbelief sweeps over Lambert's features.
What do you mean? What's going on?
He quickly updates Lambert, telling him about the email with the link to a newspaper story this morning about the murder of a 22-year-old woman and about the note that came with the floral delivery, bearing the Chicago coordinates.
You say Lucinda got the flowers last night, at home?
Yes. Why?
So she was home in Philadelphia last night when this woman was killed in Chicago?
I just told you she was.
Okay.
Randy looks at his friend for a long moment. He doesn't like what he sees in his eyes.
I have to go, he says abruptly.
Go where?
Home, he lies, and reaches for the doorknob.
Randy, wait.
What?
We can place her at the crime scene here. Lucinda.
Yeah, I know she was at the scene. She made the call.
No, Randy, she was inside the house. Inside the bathroom. With Carla.
His hand frozen on the knob, Randy asks, Why do you think that?
I know it. I told you, there's evidence.
Randy turns to look at Dan, his thoughts racing.
Are you saying she's a suspect?
I'm saying she might become one.
Tell me why. Tell me more.
You know I can't.
Turning abruptly, Randy opens the door and walks out, closing it hard behind him.
Left alone in Lucinda's about-to-be-newly-fortified apartment, Neil dials Frank Santiago's number. He needs to be told about the flower delivery. Maybe it'll take him off Lucinda's trail for 5 minutes. Long enough to find some leads that might take the investigation in the right direction. But Frank's phone rings into voicemail. Again, fourth time this morning. Neil hangs up and wonders whether he should just drive out to Long Beach Island, talk to him in person. That, or tell Lucinda that she's about to be interviewed again for a crime she didn't commit, because her hair was found in the dead woman's hand.
How did it get there?
That's what they'll ask her. As if Lucinda would know.
The killer put it there, of course. The killer left the bloody ring in her apartment, and before that, the scrapbook. He could easily have stolen strands of her hair from a brush.
Lucinda is being set up for this murder.
Why? Neil hasn't a clue. But the sooner he can get Frank to accept the possibility, the better.
He snaps his phone closed, and it rings almost immediately. Maybe Frank was screening his calls and is getting back to him right away.
Snapping it open, he looks at the number.
Nope, not Frank.
Lucinda, I'm still at your...
Neil, hold on, listen to me. There was another murder last night. A woman in Chicago.
He sucks in his breath.
How do you know?
Someone sent me a link to a newspaper article about it.
Who?
There's a pause.
I don't know. It came from an email address I didn't recognize.
Are you sure it's a real case?
Positive. And it was the same M.O. as Carla Barakat. The victim lived alone, and she was killed in her apartment early last night. Stabbed to death.
None of that means it's connected to Carla.
No, but Neil, someone sent me the link anonymously. What do you think it means?
He let it sink in for a minute. Does Frank Santiago know about this?
I don't know. Randy said he isn't in the office and nobody seems to know where he is.
You told Randy?
Yes. He and I are catching a flight to O'Hare right now. I'm in a cab on my way to the airport.
Are you kidding me? You can't...
Neil, this is what I do, remember? If I can go to the scene, I might be able to pick up on some information that will lead us in the right direction to get this guy before he does it again.
She's right. This is what she does. But, Lucinda, this is different. This time you're directly involved. He's been taunting you. Don't you think it's possible that he might be baiting you? She hesitates.
It's possible, but I have to do this. You know that.
And you can't stop me. The phrase is unspoken, but it comes through loud and clear. Neil sighs.
Just be careful.
I'm always careful. How he wishes he could believe that were true. He remembers something.
Oh, and Sin?
Yeah?
I know this isn't even on your radar right now, but I got a call a little while ago. They brought in dogs and searched Isaiah Drew's dorm room.
And?
And found traces.
Traces? Drugs?
Yes, you were right.
To her credit, she doesn't say, I told you so, though under ordinary circumstances that's definitely her style. Neil hangs up, puts on his coat, and heads for the door. He opens it just in time to see a gray-haired man bending over the mat, something in his hand.
All right, Mr. Santiago, are you ready?
Ready?
Ready to be rolled once again into that hulking metal coffin of sorts, so that they'll be able to tell just how long it will be before he'll be encased in a real one?
Yes,
he says, only after giving the magnetic resonance imaging technician a look, one that tells her he finds her breezy demeanor insufferable. A middle-aged grandmother type, her doughy figure encased in scrubs, she ignores the look.
All righty then, I'm going to have you lie down here and we'll get started. Careful of your IV line now. There we go, that's it.
He settles himself on the narrow, flexible surface and swallows audibly as he stares at the ceiling. He does his best not to let anxiety take over, does his best to keep breathing slowly, in, out, despite the chronic wheezing tightness in his chest. Dr. Rubin, his oncologist, offered him a sedative, as always, to calm the unpleasant panic sensations most people, even those who are not particularly claustrophobic, experience inside the MRI machine. Frank turned down the offer, as always. He turned it down even though he's been fiercely claustrophobic since childhood, when a neighborhood girl locked him in the basement while he was babysitting so that she could make out with her boyfriend. He's going to work as soon as he gets out of here, and he can't afford to be any more clouded than he already has been on the job. Particularly since no one at work, or really, outside of his oncologist's medical circles, is aware that cancer is spreading lesions like lethal black confetti through Frank Santiago's organs.
How long do I have?
He asked Dr. Rubin back on January 2nd, when he got the news that the new year would most likely be his last. Not that Dr. Rubin would commit to that.
There's no way of knowing at this stage, Frank. If you're asking whether you should get your affairs in order, the answer is yes.
Frank's affairs are always in order. The phrasing, however, sent a stab of panic to his gut. If you're asking whether we will continue treatment, the answer is yes again. When we halt treatment, we'll discuss your options at length. When, not if. Options. As if he has any, other than whether to die at home or in some sterile hospital bed. Even there, he figures he has no options. Who's going to take care of him at home? Not his two grown kids, who have families of their own and live in Texas and Florida. Not Ellen, though she still lives less than a mile away. He's pretty sure her possessive second husband wouldn't appreciate her playing Clara Barton to her dying first. Friends and neighbors have come and gone over the years, some closer than others, almost like family when they were there. But when they're gone, they're gone. Frank's not one to live in the past or keep in touch much. When the time comes, then, he supposes, he'll just take a cab, or will it be an ambulance, to the hospital, and check in and wait to die. Now there's something to look forward to. First, of course, he'll have to tell his kids, and the people at work. Something else to look forward to.
Damn it to hell, how can this be happening to him? He's already made up his mind to keep things status quo for as long as possible. Keep living in his own house. Keep going about his usual business. Keep working, even if the condition they call chemo brain is impairing his better judgment. Can you hear me, Mr. Santiago? The damned technician again, this time filling his entire head with her false cheerfulness, her voice coming in over the earphones she placed on him.
Loud and clear.
Ready?
Ready to be sealed into a space so confining that you literally can barely lift a finger, and your own hot, moist breath boomerangs back at your face?
Ready to be assailed by noise, not just her voice, but the lame music they pipe in, and the harsh metallic chugging and whirring of the machine as it surveys the cancer-pocked landscape of your organs? Ready to find out whether you get to die in the near as opposed to nearer future?
Ready, Frank Santiago says grimly, and the process begins.
Who are you? They say it in unison, both Neil and the gray-haired stranger at Lucinda's door. Instinctively, Neil's hand brushes against his gun, concealed beneath his coat.
I'm Bradley Carmichael. I'm a friend of Lucinda's.
Neil relaxes just a bit. So this is the famous Bradley. He's a handsome man, probably about Neil's age, with a muscular build and perfect white teeth.
Who are you? I'm a friend of Lucinda's, too. What is that you're holding?
Neil eyes the brown paper-wrapped package in his hand.
I don't know. I found it propped against the door just now. Is she here?
No, she's not.
Bradley frowns.
Are you sure? Because she's expecting me.
Neil raises an eyebrow at that. Lucinda didn't mention anything about expecting company, but then she was awfully agitated about the flowers earlier, and about Chicago just now when he talked to her. Maybe she forgot. Or maybe this guy is up to something. Either way, Neil isn't taking any chances. When Bradley says,
I'll just come in and wait for her,
Neil steps into his path.
Why don't I call Lucinda?
He suggests, keeping one hand over his weapon as the other reaches for his cell phone.
And check with her.
Bradley shrugs.
Good idea. Tell her that I just took the train down from New York to see her, so she'd better get her butt home.
Neil dials Lucinda's phone and is relieved when she picks up on the first ring.
Sin, I'm still at your place.
Yeah?
Your friend Bradley is here.
She gasps. Bradley! Oh no, I forgot.
So you were expecting him?
Neil relaxes another notch.
Yes, it totally slipped my mind. Tell him I'm really sorry, and I'll have to catch him next time.
She says she's sorry and she'll catch you next time,
Neil tells Bradley, who frowns.
Where is she? Where are you, Lucinda? Here, can I talk to her?
Neil reluctantly hands over the phone, hoping Lucinda knows better than to give anything away. She might trust Bradley, but right now, Neil doesn't trust anyone.
No, it's okay. I understand.
Yes, but I can just wait here at your apartment for you to come back, Bradley offers into the phone.
What?
No, your friend let me in, but I have your keys.
Oh, I didn't know you'd changed them.
Okay, well, then I guess I don't have your keys anymore. Still, I can stick around.
No? All right.
All right, fine.
Whatever.
Whenever.
Okay, goodbye.
Wait, don't hang up.
Neil reaches for the phone.
Too late.
Sorry.
Bradley thrusts it at him.
I'll take that package, Neil tells him, and Bradley hands it over as well.
Goodbye,
Neil calls after him as he heads down the stairs. He hears a grumbled response from below before the door to the street opens and slams shut.
Temperamental actors,
Neil shakes his head. Then he looks down at the package in his hand. Lucinda's name is scrawled on the plain brown wrapping.
in what looks like red lipstick. When Randy spots her sitting at the airport gate, she looks like someone else. This, he realizes, is mainline Lucinda Sloane. How easy it is to forget where she came from when she's wearing jeans and drinking Pepsi from a can, waves of unfettered hair streaming over her shoulders and down her back. Today, it's tamed in a sedate chignon. Even from here, he can see that she's got makeup on, and she's wrapped in what looks like a woolen blanket. A dress coat, he realizes, as he draws closer. He slows his pace, watching her, wondering why, no matter how she looks or where he sees her, she always makes him feel this way. What way? How does she make you feel? Randy's been asking himself a lot of questions lately, and they always seem to involve Lucinda. He never has any answers. But looking at her across the bustling concourse, he's certain of one thing. She had nothing to do with Carla's death. He doesn't give a damn what the evidence says or what people think. He'd bet his life on Lucinda Sloane's innocence. Chapter 15. Ladies and gentlemen, please remain seated with your seatbelts fastened while we're taxiing toward the gate. If you have a cell phone where you can easily get to it, you're free now to make a call. Lucinda immediately reaches into her pocket. She finds her BlackBerry, along with a packet of chocolate-covered peanut butter eggs she stashed there this morning. Nibbling one, she checks her phone and finds an urgent text message from Neil. Call me as soon as possible. She licks the chocolate from her thumb and dials, glancing over the seat back to find Randy. They couldn't get seats together. He's sitting several rows behind her. Seeing her, he shoots her a questioning look. She holds up her phone, mouthing, "Neil." He answers on the first ring. "Lucinda, where are you?" "On the ground in Chicago. We just landed." She speaks in a low voice, conscious that the male passenger next to her has folded his newspaper and puts it away. "What's up?" "There was a package on your doorstep earlier, not from a delivery service or anything, just a box wrapped in brown paper with your name on it." He pauses. "Your friend Bradley picked it up."
"And?"
"And we've brought him in for questioning." Her heart skips a beat.
"Why? You don't think..."
"All I know is that he was there, and he handled the package. It's in the crime lab now, and we need to rule out that he's the one who put it there."
"It's in the crime lab? Why?"
"Your name was written in red lipstick on the box, Sin."
"What was in it?"
"Just a blue tissue, stained with a red lipstick kiss."
As promised, Jason Charniok meets Cam at the door of the machine shop in an industrial stretch of a suburban town called Lackawanna. The double-chinned man with the graying blonde mustache, thick aviator glasses, and Buffalo Sabres cap looks nothing like the good-looking athlete in his yearbook photo taken almost 40 years ago. But the name stitched on an oval patch on his blue mechanics uniform reads Jason. And when she called him earlier, after tracking him down with Janet O'Leary's help, he told her that he had, indeed, been Sandra Wubner's high school sweetheart. If he thought it was an odd question, he didn't let on over the phone. He agreed to talk to her and asked that she meet him here at the machine shop when his shift ended. She's dangerously close to missing her flight home, but she's trying not to think about that right now. A phone call to Mike on her way over here confirmed that poor little Grace is still miserable.
"She probably wants to nurse," Cam told him, plagued with guilt. "Are you holding her close to your chest the way I do when you feed her?"
"Yeah, I am, but my chest is missing a key component," he said dryly.
"I'm serious, Mike. I'm worried about her."
"Don't be. She'll get through the day on a bottle. Just do what you have to do in Buffalo."
What she has to do in Buffalo is ask Jason Charniok about his long-dead girlfriend. hardly a pleasant task.
We can talk in here.
He leads the way to a break or waiting room that consists of a couple of chairs with plastic seats and two vending machines, one of which bears a handwritten out-of-order sign. The scent of stale cigarette smoke and motor oil permeates the air. Cam finds this place is more depressing, somehow, than the cancer hospital was. At Roswell, she felt a sense of real hope amidst the despair of human beings caring for each other. Janet O'Leary was a big part of that perception. She told Cam a little about her work, saying, "My job is to accept patients for whoever they are and to help them to use their faith to accept the losses that come with living with or dying from their diagnosis." Cam couldn't help but think of her father and the losses he never learned to accept. If she does learn the truth about Ava's death, it won't change anything for Ike. It's too late now. He's not all there most of the time, and when he is, what comfort will there be in learning that his firstborn was murdered? From Roswell, Cam very nearly drove straight to the airport and headed home, thinking maybe she should just forget about it. But she couldn't bring herself to do that. Because while the truth can't help her father now, maybe it can bring her, if not comfort, then closure.
"Have a seat. Want a can of pop?"
Jason asks her, gesturing at the vending machine that works. On his grease-stained left hand is a gold wedding band. "No, thank you." Cam imagines him getting over Sandra all those years ago, moving on, marrying someone else. She wonders if he's ever still haunted by what happened. Probably. You don't just get over something like that.
"I'm going to get one. Hang on a second."
He feeds in a dollar bill and then another. The second one spits out of the slot again with a whirring sound. Jason attempts to get it in several more times, cursing under his breath when the machine won't take it, and fishing in his pockets for another single. "Here you go." Cam hands him one from her purse, which he can't help but think retails for more than he must make here in a week.
"Okay, thanks."
He offers her the crumpled dollar the machine wouldn't take. She shakes her head. "It's okay."
"No, take it. Unless you're planning to use it in some stupid machine," he adds with a grin.
She smiles back and accepts the dollar, deciding she likes him. Watching him take the Pepsi from the machine, she wonders how he dealt with his loss all those years ago. According to Janet, he and Sandy had gone steady all the way through high school and into her freshman year at Buff State. "Jason," she said, "went to work right out of high school."
"So you knew Sandy?"
he asks, after taking a swig of Pepsi and settling in the chair opposite hers. "No, I actually didn't."
"Oh, I thought that's why you were here."
He looks confused. "I'm here because I'm looking into her death." Jason raises a dubious blonde eyebrow.
"Are you a cop?"
"No."
"Reporter?"
"No, I'm just someone who also lost someone very dear to me, right around the same time. My sister. They said it was a suicide, too, but I'm not so sure."
"Yeah? Because I wasn't so sure either, back then, with Sandy."
Her heart pounds. "You weren't? Why not?"
"No one knew this." He leans forward conspiratorially. "But we were gonna get married."
"Really?"
"Yep. Sandy was real excited about it. After she got through college, she was gonna be a teacher. We were planning to settle down and get a house and have a bunch of kids. That was the plan. When she died, I was saving up to buy her a pre."
"A pre?"
"Pre-engagement ring."
Lost in his bittersweet memories, Jason falls silent. "You said you didn't think at the time that Sandy killed herself, Jason."
"Nope."
"Then you thought someone else killed her?"
"I didn't know what to think. When that little kid she was watching that night said she saw me there, I got scared, you know, because I wasn't there, and I thought they thought I was. They checked out my alibi. Thank God I had one. I was at a Sabres game that night with my dad and a couple of his friends."
so then they figured the little kid must have been wrong about someone's being there.
Did you think she was wrong?
I don't know.
So you thought someone else might have been there with Sandra? Some other guy? Or man?
You mean, did I think she was cheating on me?
He looks defensive.
Nope, no way, not her. We were in love. We were going to get married.
Maybe it really would have happened, Cam thinks.
Maybe he'd have married the beautiful college girl who wanted to become a teacher.
Or maybe they would have become more entrenched in their separate worlds over time, grown apart, broken up. Maybe, when Sandra Wubner died, she was already moving on. Maybe there really was someone else. Maybe she, like Ava, had gotten involved at college with something that she shouldn't have.
If she wasn't cheating on you, but you're not sure she took her own life, who did you think was with her at the Toscano's house that night?
She asks Jason.
Who did you think killed her?
I don't know. A stranger, maybe? Stuff like that happens. Look, to be honest with you, it didn't matter to me back then because she was gone. And the last thing I wanted the cops to do was start in on me again.
Why worry if you were innocent?
He shrugs.
Innocent people get arrested all the time.
Yes, Cam thinks. And sometimes guilty ones go free. Lucinda and Randy step out of a cab on a side street off West Division and look around at the dusk-cloaked buildings.
Over there. That must be it.
Lucinda follows Randy's gaze to a narrow three-story brick facade, fronted by several squad cars, a news van, and a telltale strip of yellow crime scene tape. Looking up at the building's brightly lit second-story windows, Lucinda experiences a sudden flash of violence. Just a snatch of a scream, a fleeting glimpse of spattering blood, a howl of
laughter?
Laughter. Yes, and the jarring sound makes her skin crawl.
What's wrong?
Lucinda blinks and looks up to see Randy watching her.
Nothing, just... That's the place, definitely.
With a shudder, she shakes her head to banish the echoing laughter.
Did you see something?
Not really, just blood. But I heard something.
What?
Someone laughing,
she shudders. Randy looks concerned.
Do you want to, I don't know, wait here while I go speak to them?
He points to a heavy-set man in a trench coat, smoking a cigarette on the sidewalk in front of the building, talking to a uniformed officer who appears to be barely out of his teens.
No, I'm fine. You know I'm used to this kind of thing. Let's go.
They make their way over to the two men, who by now have noticed them and are watching warily. Randy opens his wallet and flashes a badge.
I'm Detective Randall Barricat from Long Beach Township in New Jersey. This is Lucinda Sloan. She works with the Philadelphia Police Department.
She doesn't have a badge, but she does have ID, which she holds up for their perusal.
Neither man bothers.
The one in the trench coat stubs out his cigarette beneath a scuffed black shoe.
What can we do for you today?
This is where Jamie Dobiak was stabbed to death last night, right?
Surprise, and perhaps suspicion, filters into his eyes.
And you know that because...
We read it in the newspaper.
His eyes narrow.
Which newspaper?
Randy looks questioningly at Lucinda.
It was the Chicago Daily News, she tells the detective, wondering why it matters.
That's impossible.
Why?
For one thing, that's a morning paper. There was no information about this homicide available when it went to press.
He jerks a thumb at the lone news van parked across the street.
The next of kin was notified an hour ago, and the media is just starting to pick up on the story now.
It was the online version,
Lucinda says slowly, reaching into her pocket for her BlackBerry.
What time did you say you read this?
I don't know. About a quarter after 11, maybe?
The detective is shaking his head before she's even done speaking.
Nope. That's impossible. The victim wasn't even found until almost noon.
Neil, Frank Santiago.
A brusque voice greets him on the phone.
I got your message.
Messages, actually. Neil has left a couple more since he saw what was in the package on Lucinda's doorstep, and since hearing the latest news from her and Randy in Chicago. Neil gestures to Roz that he's going to step outside to take the call.
Mm-hmm.
Roz barely looks up from the object on the table. Under bright lights, as the forensics team does their thing. In the corridor, Neil asks Frank,
Where are you now? I just got into my office. Why? We need to talk. About? About the Barakat case. There's been further communication from Carla's killer. And last night, there was another murder.
There's a pause.
What are you talking about?
Neil tells him about the woman in Chicago. Hearing the clicking of a keyboard on the other end of the line, he knows Frank is looking for information.
You won't find anything about it yet. It just happened.
He doesn't bother to explain how it is that they've known about it for hours already.
We confirmed it with the CPD, Frank.
You said there was communication? What kind?
Lucinda got an email this morning.
On the other end of the line, Frank exhales loudly. Not a sigh, exactly, but close.
She was with me last night, Frank, in case you are wondering.
Of course she was.
Are you saying you doubt me? Do you think I'm covering for her?
Did I say that? Where is she now?
Neil ignores the question.
A package was left at her door today.
What was in it?
A blue tissue stained with a red lipstick kiss, and microscopic droplets of blood. Forensics is on it now. Looks like it might have come from the Chicago victim's mouth.
Vic? Startled, he spins around in his chair. Kitty is home from work. He didn't even hear her come in. As she crosses the room, lit only by the glowing computer screen in front of him, he sees that night has fallen without his even having realized it.
Why are you sitting here in the dark?
Kitty flicks on a lamp, and he blinks.
Working on the book?
Working on catching this guy and hoping that makes it into the book, he says resolutely, as Kitty sits on the love seat and unzips the high-heeled leather boots she's wearing. I heard from him again today.
She looks up, startled.
What?
He clicks the mouse a couple of times, bringing up on the screen a copy of the latest note, written in red lipstick. He'd scanned it and the envelope into the computer earlier, before dutifully handing them over to the field office agents. Kitty pulls off her boots and crosses the room in her stocking feet to stand behind him.
Where were you last night? I thought you might try to rescue her, she reads aloud. R.I.P. Jamie, March 20th, 7:05 p.m.
Vic silently clicks the screen again, bringing up the Chicago Daily Times homepage and pointing to the breaking news item he finally found there a little while ago, after repeatedly checking this and other Chicago news sites all afternoon. Kitty reads the lead paragraph about a young woman named Jamie Dobiak who was murdered sometime early last evening in her apartment.
Oh no, Vic.
Sick bastard. He mailed this letter 3 days ago.
Knowing exactly when he was going to kill her? Right down to the minute?
Yes, and that it would be too late by the time I got it. He's taunting me, Kitty.
Clearly shaken, she sinks into a chair.
I don't like this.
I don't either. But if this is how he's going to play it,
then game on, he thinks grimly. It doesn't take long. Once Chicago's Bureau of Investigative Services gets hold of the emailed link Lucinda received this morning, for them to determine what both Lucinda and Randy instantly realized earlier. It wasn't a true link to the Chicago Daily Times. Rather,
It led to a convincing dummy website featuring not just actual stories from the morning paper, but also a genuine-looking article about a murder that had yet to be discovered. Noon Central Time, when the victim was found, would have been 1 o'clock Eastern Time. By then, Lucinda and Randy were already on their way to the airport. The Bureau's computer technicians are already trying to trace the origins of the fake website as well as the email address, but warned that whoever created them most likely covered his tracks well. Sitting in a glass-walled room opposite Detective Bob Rheingold, now minus the trench coat, Lucinda and Randy have walked him through the events that led them here, beginning with the scrapbook on Lucinda's bed back in February. Lucinda expects him to bat a skeptical eye when she admits that she isn't exactly an ordinary detective, but he seems to take it in stride, leading her to believe that he might have consulted police psychics himself. She wouldn't dare ask him, though, knowing it isn't something many law enforcement officials are willing to discuss. For the most part, the man just listens and nods, taking notes and occasionally asking clarifying questions. Of particular interest to him are the longitude and latitude coordinates left at the scene, the wristwatch, and the red lipstick used on anonymous communication received by both Lucinda and Camden Hastings. Lucinda suspects similar details might tie Jamie Dobiak's murder to Carla's. Of course, Rheingold doesn't offer the information, and both she and Randy know better than to ask about it. As their tale winds down, a phone rings on the desk.
Yeah?
Rheingold barks into it. Then, after a moment,
this is him.
Another pause, then,